Good morning. In reading through the description of today's panel, I actually saw that it noted that one of the terrible, or at least interesting, futures that may be upon us is the VCR that does not respond to its owner's commands. And I was thinking that the future does resemble the past actually quite well. It's rare that my VCR actually obeys my commands, and I'm not even aware of any special hardware or software installed in it to make it act so willfully. My name is Jonathan Zittrin. I'm Executive Director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. And today's panel is When Copy and Paste Don't Work, Implications of Trusted Systems or Copyright Management Systems. Now is your chance to flee if this is not the panel you wanted. And we have with us a wonderful panel today to discuss these implications. First, we have Mr. Jim Schindler from Hewlett-Packard, Vice President there. He will be able to speak to the technology of trusted systems and copyright management systems, the balance between security and utility. We also have with us Professor Pam Samuelson, professor at UC Berkeley, also co-director of their Center for Law and Technology. Speaking next will be John Gilmore. John Gilmore is co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and a consumer, an advocate, an engineer, and somebody who knows quite a lot about this stuff. Finally, Professor Julie Cohen, professor at University of Pittsburgh School of Law. So what we were thinking is we'll start off and ask each speaker to make remarks for about 10 minutes, no more. I'll try to keep some eye on the clock. In the true spirit of trusted systems, what we would do is actually shut off the mic after 10 minutes rather than ask you to stop speaking. But I'm not sure we'll enforce it as strictly as all that. So James will go first, speak, and then Professor Samuelson, then Mr. Gilmore, and then Professor Cohen, speak a little bit among ourselves, and then get it open to audience participation as much as possible. By way of the briefest introduction, I'll just say it's interesting, this is in the law track of the conference. Some of our speakers today will be speaking about law, in particular bills pending before Congress that would make it illegal or in some cases actually criminal to hack a copyright management scheme or otherwise break it for whatever purpose. But what we're thinking about is the substitution of code for law. Instead of actually having a rule and then a sanction if you break the rule, and of course can be found, and then after you have been found breaking the rule, there's a trial or a threat, and after the trial and the threat, they punish you, and it's the threat of that that makes you behave by respecting copyright. Instead, this is actually the code going ahead and protecting it. It'll be your VCR, your computer, your software, your hardware that actually enforces the rules that the manufacturers want. And with no further ado, let me turn it over to Jim Schindler to speak to the first aspect of this. Jim?
Thank you, Jonathan. Let me make a couple of corrections there. I'm not the vice president at Hewlett-Packard. I'm the information security program manager for HP, responsible for making sure that HP's products across the product line meet or exceed our customers' requirements for security. And so as a result of that, I've been involved with trusted systems from a DoD perspective, going back to the early 80s. And now, of course, we're seeing the majority of our security requirements coming from the commercial sectors, specifically banks, insurance companies, petrochemical companies. Everybody is very concerned about the security of their data in the international arena. One of the things that you have to understand that as Lou Gerstner was saying this morning, it is a global economy. And Hewlett-Packard has manufacturing facilities worldwide. About 50% of our sales come from the U.S. Actually, a little over 50% of our sales come from outside the United States, about a 48-52% split. So we're very concerned about the global economy. As a result of that, when you come down to issues such as copyright issues, we have to look at what are the global copyright issues that we in the world are facing. Oftentimes we see differing policies where the copyright issues associated with one entity do not necessarily agree with the copyright issues associated with another entity. Libya, for example, would be one good example in comparison and contrast to, let's say, the United States and France or anything else. So if you could just envision it not to be a local issue associated with a given economic entity or geographic entity such as a nation state, but it's a global issue that really has to be addressed, and we in the manufacturing sector then have to understand how we can sell products into this global economy. And so the model that we're proposing, that we think about today, is a model that is actually based on resolving the differences that might exist in the copyright issues within various entities. If you could, on one hand, you've got, let's say, copyright policies associated with Economic Entity 1, Economic Entity 2, and Economic Entity 3 going out over the cloud of the Internet and trying to be resolved somehow in matching or communicating this particular information, resolving the differences in the copyright issues with the similar set policies A, Policy B, and Policy C. Therein lies what I'm proposing we need is a network policy server or a set of network policy servers to help resolve discrepancies that may exist within the copyright policies. Then, of course, if you agree with this particular model, you then have to ask what is the manufacturing sector going to do to ensure that it does meet these policies, able to resolve discrepancies in copyright policies. And as a result of that, you're looking at building a set of metrics, building a set of test suites, and understanding that the manufacturers such as Hewlett-Packard and all the other major manufacturers of computer systems throughout the world can provide products into the global marketplace. So with that, I'd just like to say that a network policy server might be a solution around which we can resolve the differences here. In summary, once you establish a network policy server or network policy servers, then of course you're going to have to ask, well, how do you go about testing for their validity and ensuring that, of course, they're used appropriately by their end users. So I'll close there, Jonathan. Hand it over to
I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk with you a little bit about some of the legislation that has been proposed to regulate both acts of circumvention of technical protection systems and also technologies that have circumvention-enabling uses. Since the summer of 1994, when the Clinton administration published its green paper on intellectual property and the NII, it has been clear that there would be a push for new legislation to regulate and in some sense legally reinforce technical protection systems to protect them against hacking and the like. The white paper initially proposed to outlaw technologies whose primary purpose or effect was to circumvent technical protection systems used by copyright owners to protect their works, even without the felony provision that Hollywood had been hoping for. This proposal met with some opposition in Congress the first time that it was introduced in the fall of 1995. As the white paper legislation languished in Congress, in part because of opposition to this particular provision, Bruce Lehman, who was not only the proposer of the white paper legislation, but also the principal negotiator for the United States at the World Intellectual Property Organization negotiations about a new digital copyright treaty. Commissioner Lehman proposed virtually an identical provision to the anti-circumvention provision that had been in the white paper and the white paper legislation to put it into the draft treaty saying, as he put it,
that he would try for a second bite at the apple in Geneva, because maybe if he got an international treaty that adopted this particular approach, it would be easier to persuade Congress that it should ratify the proposal that had been negotiated over there. In fact, there was substantial opposition to the same anti-circumvention provision when it was proposed in Geneva, and in fact, it was not only the delegations of many other parts of the world, but also a number of U.S. firms acting as non-governmental observers at the diplomatic conference that raised issues about the proposed treaty provision on anti-circumvention, and so the WIPO copyright treaty that was finally concluded only contains a provision that requires adequate protection and effective remedies against acts of circumvention of technical protection systems for infringing purposes. Opposition to the white paper proposal was so strong in the United States that, in fact, Commissioner Lehman was not able to go to Geneva and push for the proposal that he, in fact, had authored, but was under instructions because of lobbying pressure that had been brought upon the administration to support the compromise provision that, in fact, was in the final treaty. Now, the principal concerns that were raised by international delegations about the anti-circumvention proposal that was made in Geneva had to do with the effect that that regulation would have on fair uses and also on access to public domain information. Interestingly, the concerns of most of the U.S. firms that were raising questions about this really had to do with the chilling effect that they thought such a regulation would have on investment in software and hardware technology that might benefit the public, in part because the provision that had been proposed had no knowledge or intent requirement to enable infringement, but rather was a kind of strict liability proposal that would outlaw the technologies themselves. In the aftermath of the WIPO negotiations and the successful conclusion of the treaty, one might have thought that the Clinton administration would, in fact, decide that it was time to seek a compromise proposal that both Hollywood and also the software and hardware industry could live with, but in fact, this was not the route that they chose. The legislation that they have chosen, although better than, from my standpoint, than the legislation that they initially sought, still has Hollywood's endorsement, but not the endorsement of the major hardware and software companies that have been expressing concerns about this for a long time. So what is the administration's bill, and why is it of some concern? One provision of H.R. 2281, which the administration favors, and which, by the way, the administration has admitted is more than is required to comply with the WIPO copyright treaty, the first provision is one that would outlaw the act of circumvention of technical protection systems. The second component of it would outlaw technologies primarily designed or produced to circumvent technical protection systems or that have limited commercial uses other than to circumvent technical protection systems. And Hollywood is very pleased to see that the felony provisions are back in this particular bill. And the push has been on in the last couple of weeks to get this particular legislation through Congress, and the Judiciary Committee has, in fact, on the House side, approved 2281, and it's awaiting some action in the House. And very recently, the Senate passed S-2037, which has a set of amendments to this anti-circumvention provision, but nonetheless it has passed the Senate with these various amendments, which I'll talk about in a minute. You might ask yourself, well, why is Why is outlawing the act of circumvention a problem? Well, one of the reasons is because one presumes if the act of circumvention is outlawed, that there are no legitimate reasons to circumvent a technical protection system. And in my view, in fact, there can be quite a number. One that I often cite to representatives of the copyright industries is, suppose that somebody has wrapped something up in a technological lock, and you have reason to believe that inside that locked up stuff is in fact infringing material. To circumvent a technical protection system in order to detect whether or not infringement has taken place seems to me to be a legitimate thing. Circumvention also to discover other illicit material, whether it's obscene material, child pornography, gambling, evidence of toxic waste, etc., is another class of things that one can imagine circumventing to be a legitimate kind of thing. There is actually, in the present bill, there was not in the original bill, a law enforcement exception, but it seems to me that it's not just the police who might need to circumvent in order to determine whether these illicit materials are in fact available. Another kind of circumvention activity, which is widespread in one sector, is computer security research. It is impossible to do computer security research without trying to circumvent technical protection systems. And why would you want to allow that research to go on? You want the research to go on because it's going to lead ultimately to stronger and better technologies to protect computers against break-ins. And there are also instances I can think of, at least, where circumventing in order to engage in fair use is an appropriate thing to do. And let me give you one specific example. A friend of mine who's a researcher at Xerox PARC defeated a technical protection system for a movie in order to make a short clip of the use of the word redskin in an old 1940s movie to show that it was derogatory in context. He's a linguist by training. He's an expert witness in a case challenging whether or not the term redskins should be a trademark. The theory is that it's a derogatory term, and so it shouldn't be allowed to be a trademark. And so this was his way of gathering evidence to support the view that this, in fact, is a derogatory term and has been known to be for a long time. Another example is defeating a technical protection system in order to achieve interoperability. The sort of whole decompilation to get access to information that is needed in order to create an interoperable system has been a long-standing debate. Can that debate simply be circumvented by now putting a technological wrapper on it? The House bill doesn't have a provision that allows circumvention for interoperability purposes, and it seems to me that that's a kind of concern. I talk a little bit about these acts of circumvention because what I think we should be focusing on in our legislation is what the Campbell-Boucher bill, which is an alternate copyright implementation bill pending before Congress, that bill would outlaw the act of circumvention to facilitate or enable infringement. And it seems to me that that's what the legislation ought to do. That's what the treaty requires. And anything more than that, in fact, is going to have some, I think, negative consequences. Well, it'll be good for lawyers because there'll be lots of litigation. Let me turn just for a minute to to what I regard as an equally misguided, overbroad regulation of so-called circumvention technologies. And here again, it's important to recognize that this is something that would outlaw, would create as an act of infringement, something which doesn't require an actual underlying act of infringement, right? What this bill would do was make the act of circumvention and the act of distributing technologies with circumvention-enabling uses to be outlawed without regard to whether or not there ever has been any copyright infringement as we understand it. And one of the things that this provision does is really focus on the circumvention, not what uses the circumvention might have. That is to say, there might be some good uses because there are some legitimate reasons to circumvent technical protection systems. These things are dual-use technologies, not simply technologies that have these illicit infringement oriented uses, and I think that I haven't been persuaded that we need anything more than the Sony Betamax standard, which asks whether or not a technology has a substantial non-infringing use, and maybe we ought to regulate those that don't have any substantial non-infringing uses, but this broad regulation that's being sought in Congress is really being enacted so that copyright owners can engage in what I think of as in terrorem uses of this bill to try to persuade software and hardware companies to do things which will restrict uses that can be made of work, and also I think it will give rise to some strike suits because it's hard to predict what technologies will be used for when they are out in the marketplace, and owners or equipment manufacturers and software developers have raised lots of questions about whether or not this bill adequately protects and balances the public interest. So one question then, this is really a battle between Hollywood and Silicon Valley, and it seems to me that Hollywood has won the initial round in Congress, but I'm hoping that there will be a chance in the House to create something that's a little bit more balanced than the legislation that we have right now. My own preference would be to wait for a little while. The National Research Council has put together an intellectual property study committee with computer scientists, people from IBM and a number of other sectors, technology sectors, and a number of the sort of content industry sectors also. I think this group could come up with something that would be a better set of regulations rather than these overbroad ones that the administration is pushing for right now. Thanks very much.
John.
Thanks, Jonathan. I'm here to try to bring this a little bit more down to earth by talking about some things that have happened over the last decade in intellectual property protection and how they've actually ended up affecting consumers. There was a bill called the Audio Home Recording Act in 1992, and it was passed by Congress after a couple of years worth of pushing it back and forth for the same kinds of reasons. People who make audio recordings, people who make records and CDs, said these new digital media like DAT tapes are going to destroy our market. People can make perfect digital copies of our works and there's nothing we can do to stop them. And so they got a bill passed that requires that any DAT tape machine, any machine that records digital audio, has to have copy protection circuitry in it that will allow a single copy of a digital audio recording to be made, but won't make second generation copies. That the copy that you make off the original is not as good as the original. You can't make further copies from it. And to demonstrate that, well, I won't demonstrate it, but I'll show you. Here we have a Sony mini-disc deck. It was the very first generation deck. And I've been using these decks for, you know, since the early 90s to record all kinds of music, and some of it has been copyrighted and some of it has not been copyrighted. But the interesting part is how this copyright protection scheme applies when there are no actual copyright violations involved. What I have on the disc in here now actually is a recording of a band that I know called Pele Juju. They play world beat music out of Santa Cruz. I know people in the band. I know their manager. When they had a concert, I came by and said, hey, can I record it? They said, sure, no problem. So I recorded it. But it turns out I can't make copies of this. I have the permission of the copyright holder, but the machine will not copy for me. Right? I recorded my brother's wedding, and I can't make copies of that either. This is material that, you know, we own the copyright on. The machine is designed and built, so it will not make copies of that. Now, I'm sure this wasn't what Congress intended, but it was what the manufacturers intended. Right? Part of the reason I'm still using an early 90s version of the mini-disc, I mean, they've made much smaller, nicer versions, longer battery life, all of that. This is the last portable version of a mini-disc deck that Sony made that has a digital out jack on it. Right? All of their new decks have digital inputs and analog outputs. You can get the bits in, but they don't come back out. Right? Even on this deck, they made a great connector, which is different on the two ends. It means you can't plug it in to the digital out on one deck and plug it in to the digital in on the other. It doesn't fit. Right? They've made it as hard as possible for you to make copies of your own material for your own purposes. Now, all of this was done. Now, why would Sony, you know, which is a consumer products company, presumably they like to satisfy consumers, why would Sony build products that deliberately prevent the consumers from doing things consumers want to do? Well, it turns out Sony owns Columbia Records and Columbia Pictures. And they're at the forefront of this unholy alliance between content providers and equipment providers, where the equipment providers, where the content providers have made enough legal threats, which I think were generally baseless at the time they were made, saying, if you put that deck out on the market for consumers, we will sue you because you're helping people infringe our copyrights. Now, this was long after the Sony Betamax case in the Supreme Court, and it was clear that they would lose such a case if the copyright owners ever brought it. But the manufacturers knuckled under anyway, and it ended up they came to this compromise and passed a bill in Congress that says everybody, you know, their compromise was all manufacturers have to have this this technology. If Sony is going to build mini disc decks, they don't want to compete with somebody else who can build real decks that just copy digital audio for anybody who wants it copied. Now, one of the interesting parts that happened is the bill only talks about digital audio, and it never says anything about analog. So the question is, suppose you plug an analog microphone or an analog audio input into such a deck, should it treat the material as if it was copyrighted, or should it treat the material as if it's public domain or as if you're the copyright owner? Well, the bill never says, and Congress apparently never thought about it, but what the manufacturers did, of course, was to make it treat everything that comes in as if you're violating someone's copyright. They marked the material as being copyrighted and no copying allowed. So far, I mean, this has been a sort of a minor part of the market, but that hasn't really caught on. Mini discs haven't caught on too much in the U.S. But it's moving out into a much broader market. There are, since recordable CDs have come out in the computer market, a lot of people have noticed they can make their own CDs, audio CDs, by using their computers. And it's kind of a cumbersome process. You have to, you know, download audio, sort of scan it in, and compose yourself a big thing, taking up hundreds of megabytes of disk space, and eventually squirt it out onto a CD. It's not the kind of thing that consumers like to do. It's a whole lot easier to pop in a tape and hit record. So eventually, manufacturers of audio equipment realized there's a market for machines where you can pop in a CDR and hit record, and you get out recordings on a CD. Philips and Pioneer and maybe a few other manufacturers now have machines on the market that do this. these machines, because of this law, are required to implement the Audio Home Recording Act. And the result is you can't take the 50 cent or a dollar CDR blanks that you can buy for computers and put one in the drive. You have to put in a CDR audio drive blank, which instead of costing less than a dollar, costs between $5 and $20. And also the manufacturers end up paying royalties. Part of the compromise in this bill was that there's an assumption that the end users are going to violate your copyrights. And in fact, there's a 2% royalty on the decks and a 3% royalty on the media that has to be paid. All these royalties go into a copyright fund and then get allocated by the Library of Congress to major media stars based on the proportion of sales they have of popular recordings. So not only does the required technology prevent you from making copies, it also assumes you're going to circumvent it and taxes you for it. Of course, it also assumes that rather than copying obscure music that you can't find anywhere in a record store, you're going to copy the stuff that you can walk down the street and buy for $10. Right. So when you see these bills that talk about anti-circumvention and, you know, protecting the strength of American intellectual property and all of that stuff, you have to realize that what they're doing is a scam, right? They have a strong interest in protecting their own intellectual property, but they have no interest in the rights of the consumer. They have no interest in the rights of anyone smaller than a major record company. That if you're making your own audio recordings, if you're a small garage band, if you're a small media production house or something like this, all the equipment that you can get is designed to make it hard for you. Now, it turns out this is also being applied to the next generation of this, by the way, is DVD. The whole reason that the copyright bills that Sam talked about, not the whole reason, but the reason there's so much push behind them is that DVD is the next generation of this protected technology. So far, the kind of provisions that prevent recording haven't come into effect because they haven't got the technology working to record DVDs yet. But, you know, if you read the trade publications, you find out this is a couple years behind in the pipeline and this will all be coming out. What they're doing instead is building in technology that prevents consumers and distributors from circumventing what the movie companies want, how they want to roll out the products. The DVD media comes keyed for a particular region of the world, and DVD drives come keyed for the particular region of the world they're sold in. And so if Disney wants to roll some movie out in the United States first and not put out DVDs of it until they've soaked up as much money as possible in movie theaters, and then put DVDs out. Meanwhile, in Europe, they've sent all the films from the movie theaters over to Europe, and they're raking in money over there and not letting DVDs into that market, because you could buy a crate of DVDs. You could buy one DVD and try and send it to a relative in Europe, and they'll put it in their machine, it won't play. Right? They're basically using this as a mechanism to restrain trade in their intellectual property. Now, this actually wouldn't work without some legal protection, because the technical circumvention, you know, isn't all that hard to do. Right? The stuff is encrypted with one of 6 or 7 master keys, depending what part of the world it's designed for. How long can those keys remain secret when they're putting them into millions of consumer decks? Right? Well, that's what these bills are about. They make it illegal to reverse engineer the decks to figure out how to make it possible to record things that will go into other regions. And when we get on to the recordable DVD, what you'll find is there'll be a whole raft of protections in there that are all designed to make it impossible to copy Hollywood films, and they don't really care what effect it has on everybody else. If it means you can't record, you know, your daughter's first birthday, then they don't really care. As long as you'll buy the deck and find out after you've bought it that you can't record your daughter's first birthday, it doesn't matter. So, when you hear about this stuff about anti-circumvention, don't think about, these are horrible pirates that are stealing people's intellectual property. Think about these are ordinary consumers that are trying to do something simple and obvious with their own information, with their own media, which the giant companies have restricted for their own convenience. Thank you.
I'm also going to talk about the rhetoric of trusted systems in a slightly different light. However, I'm going to talk a little bit about economics because the rhetoric of trusted systems, we need them to prevent piracy of our intellectual property, is based on a particular economic way of thinking about intellectual property that hasn't been at all empirically proved and really hasn't been that closely scrutinized either. Start with the initial story about trusted systems, that we need trusted systems to protect our intellectual property against piracy. In other words, to prevent people from stealing what we own if we are intellectual property owners. That's a little too simple because As Pam's remarks, I think, made clear when she talked about certain uses being fair uses, not everything about a piece of intellectual property, a work of intellectual property, is owned. And one thing that trusted systems highlight is that whether all uses of intellectual property are owned by the intellectual property owner is very hotly contested right now. And the decision about what uses of intellectual property should be owned by the intellectual property owner is really a policy question, an economics question. What would be the best way to strike the balance, as we in the Copyright Academy are fond of saying, between things that should be owned by the intellectual property owner and things that should be not owned, that should be free to the public, either under a doctrine of fair use or under some conception of things belonging to the public domain. So what should be owned is a policy question and a contested policy question, and trusted systems in some sense really preempt that question by providing a particular answer. Everything is owned, and everything will be delivered in a very controlled way and in a way that potentially at least allows every use of intellectual property to be metered and billed to the user's account as a microtransaction with a small fee. So trusted systems effectuate a particular economic vision of copyright, and that's what I want to explore a little bit today. The economic vision is really this. Copyright exists to cure what's known as a market failure. If we didn't have copyright, at least in the analog world, anybody could make a copy of anything, and then people wouldn't have an incentive to produce intellectual property because they wouldn't be able to be remunerated for their efforts. But on the other hand, in the analog world, sometimes transaction costs prevent socially valuable transactions. The use perhaps that one wants to make is so de minimis that it's not really worth it to go and locate the copyright owner and track him or her down and bargain for the use. Or perhaps permission wouldn't be granted because the use is derogatory in some way. Perhaps it parodies or makes fun of the copyright owner. And so the next step in the economic story that underlies the trusted systems model is, well, we do have a doctrine of fair use, and that also responds to a market failure. It allows consumers to do to make some uses for free because the uses are socially valuable when placed in context, and it's really too expensive in the analog world to bargain for them. But in the digital world, we have trusted systems which lower transaction costs, at least in theory. Right? You can get on the internet, punch in a unique digital identifier for the particular work that you're interested in, find it in a database managed by perhaps the Association of American Publishers, go to the location where the work is stored and say, I would like to print a chapter of this work for use in my history class. And pay 10 cents a page or a dollar per student or whatever the copyright owner wants to charge. And so the final piece of the economic story is now that we have trusted systems to cure the market failure that existed before when transaction costs were too high, we don't need fair use in the digital world. Fair use, someone has written, is really a question of black or white, and trusted systems permit shades of gray, permit microtransactions. And this, at least superficially, appears to be economically sound. Greater money for the copyright owner means greater incentives and therefore more works produced, allowing uses of copyrighted works to be determined through the market means that the works will be allocated to their highest and best use, the use for which most people are willing to pay the most money, and that all sounds very nice. And so those who advocate retaining the doctrine of fair use in the digital world are seen as economic dinosaurs. They don't have the best interests of copyright holders at heart. They don't have the best interests of society at heart. And they don't even have the best interests of consumers at heart, because under the system to be implemented by trusted systems, uses of copyrighted works will be cheaper, and consumers want that. What I'd like to suggest to you today is that this purported conflict between dinosaur analog notions of fair use and public domain on the one hand and the shining pure economic vision of trusted systems and a world delineated in shades of gray on the other hand is a false conflict. And it's based on the economic vision on which the trusted systems regime is to be based has some serious flaws and at the very least requires some empirical proof before we should be required to believe it. And I'd like to just highlight three areas for you, and you can draw your own conclusions. First, purely as a theoretical matter, the notion that through these microtransactions, uses of copyrighted works will be allocated through the market to their most valuable end uses, to the uses for which people are willing to pay the most, is really troubling because it assumes that number one, the uses for which people are willing to pay the most are the most socially valuable. And it's just not clear that that is true, either theoretically, because we know that some kinds of value aren't compensated in the market, or practically, because we've all seen, you know, the Barney the Dinosaur toys and the Lion King action figures at Burger King or wherever they happen to be sold. And we might at least permit ourselves a sneaking suspicion that the most remunerative types of intellectual property, while they may provide enjoyment to some, at least aren't what we would like to see absorbing the majority of society's creative effort. In other words, the value of someone's contribution to society may or may not correlate with their ability to pay the highest price. And another reason, as a theoretical matter, why this social efficiency theory is flawed is that copyright owners can perceive certain uses not to be in their best interest. If someone creates a particularly telling satire or parody of someone's work, perhaps the market for that work may diminish or dry up. If the satire or the parody is good and advances what we might like to think of as learning or scholarship, it might be in society's interest to have it, but it might not be in the copyright holder's interest to have it. And in a world dominated by trusted systems, it's quite easy for the copyright holder to achieve that result. So it's easy to see, both in theory and by using our common sense, that as this notion of complete copyright holder control might play out in the real world, it wouldn't necessarily be in the best interest of society overall. And that's a curious result for us to want, given that we started from the premise that the design of copyright, the balance between what is owned and what is not owned, is a social policy question about which we need to make an informed decision. The second area that is troubling has to do with what I like to call the consumer power argument, the argument that really the market in uses governed by trusted systems will be responsive to consumer desires, and if consumers don't like particular restrictions or want certain other types of uses, the great engine of the market will produce those results because consumers will buy or refuse to buy accordingly. That might make sense if we were talking about toothbrushes or orange juice or shoes, but we're talking about copyrighted works, and copyright was created to allow copyright holders to have some power over the market, some ability to be the unique individual or entity who controls access to a work. Therefore, at the very least, before arguments about consumer power are made, one would expect to see some actual research being done into questions like, how closely can one work be substituted for another? If consumers don't like restrictions that are placed on access to, say, the news, will they really just stop buying the news until the market has corrected whatever the perceived problem happens to be? In other words, what's the elasticity of demand for the news? Will people want it so much that they will continue to buy it anyway, even though they don't like the terms? And I want to suggest to you that we should expect those questions to be answered much more precisely than they have been before changing the entire basis of our copyrighted system from one of incomplete control by the copyright holder to one of complete control. The third area that is problematic has to do with what economists call externalities, and I don't want to get too technical, but I'm talking here about the notion that when a work is consumed, it produces value not just to the person who consumes it, but to others in society, those who interact with that person, those who have, say, for example, an interaction with a teenager on the one hand who's watched a lot of violent television and believes that one can behave accordingly, or on the other hand has watched something different that sends a different message about what's a useful and good way to behave in society. And I'm not advocating mind control. What I'm suggesting to you is that these kinds of external value that are generated by copyrighted works aren't really captured well in the market at all. So the notion that we can switch over to a trusted systems regime where we deal in shades of gray and every use of a copyrighted work must be paid for, the notion that that will lead to the greatest good for society and the most economically productive way of ordering our world doesn't seem to take those kinds of value into account, the kinds of value that are not measured, not metered in the market. And really then what I'm trying to suggest to you is that if we switch to a regime of trusted systems, a regime based on complete economic control for the copyright holder, we may create a different kind of market failure. And trusted systems therefore carry a risk of a market failure of their own. the failure to which I refer is the failure to recognize and consider the types of value that copyrighted works might create both to their users and to those who interact with their users that aren't captured in the market and that nonetheless produce effects that we like to think of as good and valuable through our system of public education, through our system of public libraries, and so on. And if that's the case, then instead of sitting here and arguing about, strike that. It's good to sit here and argue about whether trusted systems will impede computer security research, and it's definitely good to sit here and argue about whether trusted systems will make it difficult to hunt down lawbreakers. But we're taking too much for granted, even in letting those be the parameters of the argument. What we should be arguing about, I'd like to suggest, is what kind of information policy would we like to see in our society, and how can we design trusted systems that effectuate that policy, that perhaps don't measure and meter everything, that perhaps allow certain kinds of copying, that allow certain kinds of fair or free use, that allow certain kinds of access to library patrons. Trusted systems are not handed to us by some deus ex machina, and we have some power to affect their design. And instead of assuming that the only way to design a trusted system is that which measures and meters everything that it's possible to measure and meter and charge for, we should be trying to design systems for digital delivery that effectuate the kind of information policy that we would like to see for our society. Thank you.
Thank you. I was handed a note in the midst of Julie's presentation. I will share it with you right now. It says, "This is the most one-sided presentation," I take this to be collectively, not just Julie's, "the most one-sided presentation I've ever seen at a major institution." Allow me to finish. "You should be ashamed of yourself. Where is the CCC, AAP, SPA, etc., etc.?" And short of mentioning the SPCA, I would say, first, the presentation is not over. We have some time left, and we'll be making the most of it and perhaps can sit and argue about trusted systems rather than merely advocate one side of the issue. The other thing is, please don't assume a conspiracy, as may have been assumed in another area today, among the organizers of the conference, the vicissitudes of invitations and such. Actually, in this case, I can say have made it that Hollywood representatives were invited and did not end up here for one reason or another. But yes, yes. But rather than actually get to whether there's a conspiracy to exclude various tri-lettered organizations in support of Hollywood, indeed, allow me to, yes. 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 So allow me for a moment to play not just Mouse's advocate, but advocate for a whole range of content authors. And then, of course, let's open it up to the audience. By no means do I want to speak solely for Hollywood here or for anybody else who's a content author. Indeed. So let's get into it. And then I do urge you to walk up to one of the microphones at some point and actually contribute. So, John, you've actually complained a bit. You've given what I guess is called the bar mitzvah defense, which says that there are a number of special occasions in your family that you're unable to actually preserve and properly distribute to the world. And I must say, it does tug at the heartstrings to know that, you know, as Neil Stephenson said yesterday, that broken neck homepage is something that ought to be shared with the world as much as possible. But isn't the right response from the content author to say, fine, that's version 1.0. We're perfectly delighted to let you share your own content as much as you want. with others. And we're sorry that the way we designed the deck was sort of blunderbuss. It took in more than it needed to as far as protecting things. But that's okay. We're going to bring you 2.0 and 3.0. And what that will do is it will allow people who create the original, the digital original of a disk or some other media, to assert some interest in it, to say, I only want there to be one copy of this in the world. And when I lend it to somebody, I want to know that they have it. And when they give it back, I've got it back and I can lend it to someone else. I'm not required to use this system, but it's something I can use. And sure, I don't want it to affect other content to be free, but for my own content, the sweat of my brow, why should I not be permitted to protect it?
You are permitted to protect it, but am I permitted to put the terms that I want on the content I create as a consumer?
Sure. Now, you're right.
But the equipment doesn't do that, and the laws are designed to make it to keep equipment that could do that out of the market.
But what I took part of Julie's point to be, Julie said, you know, you're not really hitting the nail on the head, because Julie says what it's really about is this original content. I mean, the thing that I would say has the industry wanting to create such devices is the fear that, sure, that $10 disk, if, you know, the teenagers can copy it one to the other sort of just by touching disks or running a cable between one and the other, you bet they're not going to pay 10 bucks at the store, and that's going to destroy the market for the most popular stuff. And if you can devise the technical system to let you have your special events, but in the meantime protect my system, does that make you happy? Is that okay?
That would be okay, but I think you've set an impossible goal, because there's no way for a machine to decide what's an original work and what's a copy.
But isn't this digital watermarking? Isn't this the ability to imprint an original with some kind of tag that the machine can read that says, don't copy this?
So let's say that in the background at your daughter's first birthday party, you're playing an album, or you've got a video going in the background, and your camera detects the digital watermark that's appearing on the screen.
Eric Clapton turned out too loud in the background. We can't copy the party.
And decides that Eric Clapton owns that tape and you can't copy it.
Jim, is this really a problem? Is this actually going to be a showstopper for devising a system that protects the rights that people want and that the authors might want and that doesn't impede on John's birthday parties?
It definitely is, and it's an issue that I think we're going to be facing for the years to come. That is, one of the things we're seeing is that policies are all the time changing, and the legislation that was presented by Pam, whether it be before Congress now or before the Senate, is whether or not it passes is one issue, but what it's going to be like in the next 10 to 20 years is going to be another issue. And technology, the technology providers, such as Hewlett-Packard and the other technology providers, we provide technology. We do not make the policies. And so what we have to do in the technology community is to actually provide the technology that is flexible enough to meet a variety of policies, whatever those policies evolve to be in the legal sense, and worldwide. Bear in mind, of course, that we're looking at it from the protection of the intellectual property and the copyright issues in the United States, but this is a global issue. It is really a global issue, and what you really have to face now is the differences between the copyright laws that exist within the various entities. And so, you know, I think we need to broaden our thinking here and say, okay, that the technology providers cannot, do not, and should not make the policies. But we do have to cooperate with law enforcement agencies by providing the technology and the equipment that allows the law enforcement agencies to actually enforce the policies of the land. So that's where the manufacturing community is coming from, looking at the differences in there and making sure, of course, that the equipment is flexible enough to meet a variety of needs.
Pam, do you have a thought?
One of the concerns of equipment manufacturers, as I understand it, about some of the legislation is that there are so many different kinds of technical protection systems that people might use, and so the more general purpose the machine, the more difficult it may be to make something that in fact will read the thousand different technical protection systems that might be out there. And I think that's a challenge that the industry groups are trying to get together to do some standardization to reduce that. One of the things that happened in the Senate about this issue was to say that only active circumvention systems should be regulated, not those that passively circumvent. That is to say, if you designed a system and you didn't really intend for it to be used for these circumvention or circumvention purposes, but it simply doesn't read a technical protection system that someone had embodied in their work, then you're not going to be liable for that. And I'm hoping that that will be carried over into the House bill when they try to reconcile the two pieces of legislation.
Indeed, Pam, what I took from your remarks wasn't so much that you were against any attempt to make law help prevent people from circumventing these systems in all circumstances. You were, again, sort of working at the margins, trying to make sure it wasn't overbroad. That if somebody is actually working to crack a system that protects the Little Mermaid, you don't mind seeing a law that would go ahead and try to stop that behavior.
Yeah, I support the Campbell-Boucher bill, and it has attracted 40 sponsors or so now in the House, and actually if all of you out there wrote to your congressman, there might be more. But the Campbell-Boucher bill outlaws circumvention in order to facilitate or engage in infringement, and that seems to me to be a perfectly reasonable thing to do.
Julie, let me ask you a question before we then open it up to questions from the floor. And if people want to line up for the microphones rather than just bellow from seats, that might work better. Also, this is being recorded, and Harvard does have some proprietary interest in the event. So. Julie, you're the one who's taken the strongest stand against copyright management systems. And I just try to abstract it somewhat theoretically, saying, let's say, for instance, my roommate has a wonderful garden. He's been working a lot on this garden. It's right on the public street. People walk by. They admire it all the time. They come by with baby carriages. Somebody came out with a camcorder the other day and filmed the tulips blooming. And let's say we decided that we had value in that garden. And it's true that his original reason for putting down the bulbs was not pecuniary. He didn't want to recover money for it. But now we want to actually put up a fence. We want to put up a fence and charge admission. Kids go in free, adults pay $5, and they get to see the garden. Now, if somebody wants to try to take a plank out of the fence and capture a peek, maybe even for fair use purposes, they just want to look at it for purposes of criticism or satire. Should I really have no right to prevail upon the law to prevent somebody from sneaking that peek of my garden?
You're assuming, first of all, that you can get copyright in the design of your garden, because one thing that I was talking about in particular is the balance that is struck for copyrighted works of creative expression.
Yes,
so,
of course, I'm assuming that I can get an opaque fence.
I'd like to footnote that you may be reaching rather far afield. But in my opinion, the answer is yes, you may, under certain circumstances, have the right to sneak a peek at the garden. Perhaps a library has purchased a right of access to the garden, and its users would like to be able to each individually sneak a peek at the garden rather than themselves having to pay again for what the library has already purchased and what you have already been remunerated for. In my opinion, yes, they might well have that right. And I'd like to point out that I didn't say nothing should be owned. All I said, and I think it's a very important point that's gotten lost in the equally one-sided debate that has been taking place in Congress, is that as a matter of economic policy, it would be, in my opinion, quite a bad idea, and certainly hasn't been proven, but it's a good idea that everything should be owned.
Gotcha. Let's start up here. Yes, sir. And please try to keep it brief since we have very little time.
Sure. I'm Chris Wolf with Proskauer Rose, and I'm speaking for myself, but I want to use an anecdote to get the panel's reaction to how we control the Internet, which is, after all, the focus of the conference. I have a client who refers to the Internet as the home shoplifting network. And he does that because this is in the software industry, because there are literally thousands of FTP sites with free copies of software. 2 weeks ago, I brought a case on behalf of the Recording Industry Association of America, two cases, one in Seattle and one in Phoenix, against websites that offered MP3 versions of full-length CD recordings. They now make MP3 Man. I shouldn't tell John this, so go out and buy one, where you can go jogging or sit in airplanes with downloads from the internet. So what you didn't talk about is what happens if there weren't the interlocks. And right now on the internet, there aren't the interlocks. And I'd like to get the panel's views on how do we protect content on the internet if we don't have these technological fixes. You can't hire the lawyers in the crowd, including me, to run around the country. We're too expensive to protect copyright every time there is an FTP site that goes up.
John, do you want to start with that real quick?
Well, it sounds like you already have the solution. I mean, you are filing suit against these people. You have laws already that provide not only a way to stop them, but to recover damages, to destroy all copies they have, and the laws you have are very much biased in the favor of the copyright owner.
Well,
you don't even have to prove.
It's unwieldy. There's too many lawyers running around. It's too expensive. You can't get everybody to get an MP3.
I mean, we got two guys with two websites with about 300 infringing copies. There are literally tens of thousands of copies of infringing songs and software on the net. You simply can't have a federal court deal with every one of those infringements, where technology can provide a simple tool.
Well, but it's not, well, but the problem with the simple tool that you're offering is that it restricts a bunch of other things that you have no right to restrict under copyright law, right? My co-founder at EFF, John Perry Barlow, said it this way: when the principal item of commerce is indistinguishable from speech, right, you can't protect commerce without restricting speech. Your right to restrict the MP3 copies restricts the right of, say, small garage bands that can't sign up with a record company because record companies aren't interested in them yet, to put up their own MP3 material, because there's technological protection. It doesn't let them record one.
Can we go over here? Yes.
Yes, my name is George Cook. I'm an entertainment lawyer, and I'd like to ask the panel, with the focus they've had on federal legislation relating to copyright, don't they think it's also somewhat important for us to focus at this point what's going on in the realm of uniform commercial code legislation? I know this is something quite dear to Pamela's concerns. It's certainly a lot of concern to people in the entertainment industry, in which, in fact, the MPAA is in opposition, I might add. UCC Article 2B proposes a contractual regime in which non-copyrightable information can be perpetually controlled and protected through a copyright regime, which includes electronic self-help. And I was wondering how Pamela sees this fitting into the overall scheme and what her thoughts on this are.
Well, actually, Julie Cohen is the person who wrote a paper on the technical self-help provisions of UCC 2B, but I'm glad that you raised the issue of UCC 2B. It is something which, if you're not aware of it, you should become aware of it very soon. This is a proposal for a new model law to regulate all transactions in information. And this the paradigmatic kind of transaction is actually a license of information, and you can essentially write your own intellectual property laws embedded in the terms and conditions, and mass market licenses containing all these terms and conditions then would regulate uses that can be made of them. And as your statement suggests, what this is a kind of private copyright regime that the people can essentially create, and there are lots of issues about the intersection of intellectual property law and also technology policy that I think needs additional work. And fortunately, both the American Law Institute and the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, NCUSL as it's known, are going to take another look at it. And so although there had been a lot of effort to get this through this year, it looks like there will be another year before final approval. And hopefully then there will be a chance to raise and deal with a lot of the issues, including the self-help provisions, which it's wonderful to have something that Hollywood and I agree on.
I guess we'd note that it's actually up for final approval in July. They're going to lock the draft in July, so I think the notion of another year of discussion is maybe illusory.
Why don't I just make sure to ask the audience indulgence so that the three people left will just make sure they get their questions in before we break.
Well, actually, my name is Lois Wassoff. I'm with Houghton Mifflin Company. I had a different question, but since
sure.
We've gone off into Article 2B, I have been attending the Article 2B drafting sessions for the last 2 years with the Book Industry Observers Group. The book industry has not taken a position on Article 2B. When people ask us where we are on it, we say we're in the room. We're monitoring the process. We're trying to learn. We're trying to understand what the statute does. My understanding, actually, George, was that the MPAA is seeking delay on the statute but hasn't opposed it yet. And my understanding is that it's up before NCUSL in July, but there'll be additional drafting sessions after that, so it's not going to be locked in July. I would just also suggest, though, since Article 2B came up, there is one school of thought that has the runs the risk of creating a private law of copyright. You may have noticed me strongly agree with the comment earlier that this was a very imbalanced panel. With all due respect, I believe it was. I think, Pam, that your position on 2B is one view of how that statute reads. It's not a universally held belief, and I don't state this because the book industry decided to support it. I just think there's a broader picture. So as people are thinking about 2B, and I do agree it's very important that they do, it will affect a lot of the way business is conducted over the Internet in the future if it becomes law. I think you should look at the statute, look at the broader range of comments on it, and get maybe, with all due respect, a more balanced view of what it says.
There is actually a website that has both pro and con arguments on it. Carol Kunze has maintained this. It's called What's New in 2B or something of that sort. It's on the softwareindustry.org site, and I highly recommend it. You also might find it useful to go to the site of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology. We just had a 3-day conference on UCC 2B, and there are links to a number of sites about Article 2B and a list of some talks that were given and papers that will be published on this subject. Again, I think that it is an issue which we all ought to follow really quite closely because it's going to affect electronic commerce and information.
Yes, over here.
My name is Tom Lipscomb, and I'm both an author and also former head of the New York Times Publishing Company. I've run a couple of small high technology companies as well. I think what bothered me the most was the position that has not been represented here is what is the issue? What exactly are we talking about here? And what we're talking about is a tremendous change in the cost of replication. If one wants to take Esther Dyson's book and take it down to Kinko's, it'll cost you a lot more than buying a copy of Esther Dyson's book. But if you'd like to take 1,000 books by BNA that are law books that you pay $100 a piece for that cost about $15 to manufacture, and you can put them all on a CD-ROM, antiquated technology, that's about $10,000 worth of hard cost if it was in paper that's now 89 cents in plastic. The value copyright included is over $125,000 on that CD-ROM if you put 1,000 BNA law books on it. And so you can see the theft that is now possible is vastly larger than the thefts of copyrighted material before. This is not just a Hollywood issue. As a former member of the board of PEN, the International Writers Organization, we are all looking for the Internet and for these new technologies to make disintermediation possible whereby artists and writers of rock groups, et cetera, can reach their markets directly. But how can they do that if there's not ways of handling trusted systems to move that information through so that people can make purchases all over the world from an artist that before had to go through a record company, a rip-off distribution system, or a publishing company's inefficiencies, which I know well, having been guilty of them. My last point is I want to clarify for the professor, because he thought I was alleging a conspiracy. I don't believe in conspiracies. Laziness, arrogance, yes. Conspiracies, no.
You're very kind. Thank you. Julie, do you have a reaction to that?
Just briefly. That's nice, and I certainly don't want to dispute your numbers, and I don't want to dispute that they're important, but your comment did not at all respond to the points that were being made up here, which, if I can distill a sort of single pearl of wisdom, it would be this. The copyright laws have always struck a balance between content owners and users. It may well be that the location of that balance needs to be shifted to respond to the problem of the low cost of copying in a digital medium. But what should not be is a knee-jerk response to the very sort of powerful rhetorical notion of theft or piracy that dispenses with the balance altogether. And quoting numbers like $10,000 and 125,000 copies, or I don't remember exactly what that number was, isn't responsive to that point.
For a final question over here. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, John. You're
right. A brief two-point response on Tom's thing. First, if there is such a problem with the cost of copying, why is it that the industry is the fastest growing industry, is highly profitable, et cetera, et cetera? It seems like you're arguing that new protections are needed, but somehow even under the old protection schemes, you're making big piles of money and growing faster than any other industry. Second issue is more of a social issue. Technology has reduced the cost of copying of different kinds of information substantially over the years, and this is a trend that isn't going to stop. There's a technology on the horizon called nanotechnology, which in its full flower provides the ability to copy physical objects where the cost of copying such an object is minimal, the same way it's the cost of copying a floppy disk is minimal compared to the effort of designing it in the first place. If society doesn't come up with reasonable ways to handle these things, we will have a lot more turmoil when physically designed objects like this are just as copyable as the intellectual property inside them. So we need to work these things out now.
For a final comment or question here.
My name is Curtis Priest, and I'm director of the Center, Center for Information Technology and Society, and a number of you know me on the Internet. I've had a general proponent of fair use, and for some of the reasons that Julie Cohen mentioned in terms of the values to society, I have both a comment and a question directed towards her.
One to a customer, either a comment or the question.
Well, they're one and the same. I'll try to be very brief. Some of us who've been in policy for a number of years have realized that there are political winds that blow one way and then the other, and right now we're during a very anti-tax period. I have often viewed fair use as a form of subsidy, and in the report I wrote for the U.S. Congress in 1988, you talked about market failure. In that report I talk about nonprofit failure. Usually we expect a society to fill in the holes of the values that we need to be, you know, held up by our public schools, by our public libraries. They are supposed to then take the funds required to fill in the holes and then pay the dollar for whatever in those microtransactions you mentioned. I don't, in the perfect world perhaps, but in a non-perfect world where there's non-profit failure, where there's not enough support for the schools, not enough support for the libraries, I don't believe those funds then will be available. Then I wonder if is there an implicit political agenda right now against fair use because it represents a hidden tax from industry to these values?
Julie?
Well, that probably deserves a longer response than we have time for. I think looking at fair use as a subsidy to the consumer is in itself a political statement, because what I was trying to suggest is that the sort of breathing space for fair use that has traditionally been provided within the copyright system is a public good like public education, like public libraries, that the market will not provide on its own. I don't know if that's responsive to your question, I agree with you, I think.
I want to thank our panelists and the audience for a very stimulating session. I think I speak for all of us, and I wish we had more time. So.